Good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Wherever you are in the world, welcome to Office Hours. I'm your host, Daniel Pink, broadcasting from our state-of-the-art facility here in my garage in Washington, D.C., capital of Los Estados Unidos. Thanks for being one of the several hundred already listening live right now, and I hope among the tens of thousands who have begun to listen to this these shows on iTunes. The number of people downloading this on iTunes has really blown me away. It's really quite extraordinary. So if you're listening on iTunes right now, thank you very much. So let's get started. If you work at a large organization, think about this for a second, folks who are listening in. If you work at a large organization, have you ever sat around a table at your office and tried to answer this question? What's our core competency? Have you ever asked yourself about your career? You know, I do a lot of things, but what's my own core competency? If you've asked either of these questions, the person to blame is our next guest, Gary Hamel. He and C.K. Prahalad invented that concept, and it's proved to be truly one of the most enduring ways business people understand the notion of competitive advantage. But what's interesting about Gary Hamel is that even though that alone, along with many other writings and ideas and consulting and speaking, has made him one of the most influential management and strategy thinkers on the planet. He's a longtime professor at the London Business School. He's a guy who whispers advice in the ears of the most powerful executives. What's interesting about Gary Hamel is that he's also something of a renegade. His book, which came out a few years ago, called The Future of Management, is, to my mind, truly one of the best books on management in the last decade, in part because it challenges the very notion of management. A few years ago, he launched what he calls the Management Innovation Exchange, whose very modest goal is to reinvent and revolutionize management as we know it. And now he's out with a new book called What Matters Now. Its subtitle is How to Win in a World of Relentless Change, Ferocious Competition, and Unstoppable Innovation. It's another book that tosses a few mind grenades into the corporate boardroom. Gary Hamel, welcome to Office Hours.
Hey, Dan. Nice to be here.
Where are you right now in the world?
So I'm in Woodside, California, which is just a few miles from Stanford and Palo Alto, right in the middle of Silicon Valley.
Right in the middle of Silicon Valley. And we were talking right before the show started that Woodside is famous, along with being your hometown now, it's famous for something called Bucks. Tell us about Bucks for those of us who don't live in Silicon Valley.
You know what? If you want a definition of eclectic decor, you'd probably go to Bucks. It has everything hanging from the ceiling, from cosmonaut suits to IDEO-designed racing vehicles and so on. But I'm told it's a place where the technorati meet and big deals get done. I haven't done any big deals there, but I've seen folks like Rupert Murdoch and others having their omelets 7:30 in the morning and so on.
Wow. I have to say, seeing Rupert Murdoch eat at 7:30 in the morning is just not high on my list of life goals. But, you know, God bless him, sort of. Let me explain to you and to our guests how Office Hours works. On each program, we open the phone lines for an hour, and our guest and I, really our guest, take questions. There are questions about work and business and life and education, anything you want. Gary has been a professor for a long time, and it's like that. We open the door and see who walks in. Now, for all of you listening in live this afternoon, if you want to ask a question, all you have to do is press *2 on your phone. And my gosh, we're still getting people coming in here. You're a popular guy. All you have to do is press *2 on your phone. That will essentially allow you to raise your hand and ask a question. And our crack team of producers will see you on the control panel. I'll say your name if I can identify your name. So Ethel in St. Louis, you're on the air, and you can ask away. Now, what's also happened, which I think is really kind of cool, is that in the last several episodes, we have gotten just a flood of questions via Twitter, And, well, here we go. There are already questions coming in via Twitter for Gary. And so if you want to ask a question via Twitter, that's fine, too. Just include my handle, @DanielPink, and we'll be able to see it. But first, let's talk to Gary about his book. It's called What Matters Now. It's a really terrific book. It's I like the way that it's structured. It's short chapters, really, really, really provocative. Each one makes you say, whoa, wait a second. Gary, as you look at the business landscape, you know, and describe what matters now, embedded in this book, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, is a very powerful diagnosis of what businesses today are doing wrong. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you got to start off from a realization that we are really, truly at an inflection point in business, and I guess that gets said a lot, but I think it's really true now for three reasons. First of all, I think organizations around the world are facing some challenges that lie outside of the performance envelope of that 100-year-old management model we've been using, kind of management 1.0. Those challenges include a dramatically accelerating pace of change that can turn you from being a leader to a laggard overnight. Second challenge would be just intensifying competition around the world with a whole bunch of new entrants with low-cost advantages and so on, but just no place for inefficiency to hide. And number three, you have this move from the industrial economy to the knowledge economy, now to the creative economy, that's putting a huge premium on getting people to really bring the gifts of their initiative, their passion, and so on to work every day. So you have these new challenges that require companies to be very adaptable, very innovative, extraordinarily inspiring places to work, and most organizations are none of those things. So first you have this new set of challenges that is going to require some dramatically new responses, going to force us to rethink a lot of what we've believed over the last 100 years about management. That's number one. Number two, you have a new generation of folks coming to work whose social reality was melded by the web, and they come with a whole new set of expectations. They believe that every idea should compete on an equal footing no matter who it comes from. No, just because you're an SVP doesn't give your idea a free pass. They believe that hierarchy should be built from the bottom up by virtue of service to the community, that doesn't matter so much. And finally, they believe that what should count in an organization is your contribution, not your credentials. So those folks are only going to want to work in organizations that reflect the values that they've kind of absorbed on the web. So that's a second big reality companies have to cope with. And then I would say, thirdly and lastly, we have a whole new set of social accountabilities. Around the world, companies are being held up to scrutiny as never before, and rightfully so. Executives are starting to have to really admit that the rights their companies enjoy are socially negotiated, and society can renegotiate that anytime they like. So all of these things require, I think, kind of fundamentally new thinking, right down to the very ideology upon which our organizations are built.
Okay, so that's a sweeping – I mean, I love it. It's a sweeping analysis of why things are different. But let me take one piece of that, which is you talk about – this 100-year model, that's the word that you – phrase that you use, the 100-year model of the corporation. Why don't you give us – what are the specs of that model? And I think that identifying those will help us realize and really making them explicit. I think you've done it in your books and other writings. I think really helps us identify how much that model is out of sync with the realities that you describe.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess one of the – so a couple of quick points, Dan. One is, we're talking about management today, and I think to some people that kind of sounds boring. I must admit I've never met a 12-year-old who says, I want to grow up to be a manager. And yet, when you think about it, whether it's producing the show today or whether it's, running a church bake sale or a Global 1000 company, all of us every day are managing things. And so I start with a premise, not as management as being a set of tools, techniques, and so on, but management is how we mobilize, how we organize human beings to get stuff done. So on our Management Innovation Exchange, we talk about management as the technology of human accomplishment. So it's just incredibly important. What we can accomplish as a species is limited by what we know about how to bring people together to get things done. So having said that, in most companies, you find a very particular set of kind of management practices that have their roots back in the Industrial Revolution. And it's kind of useful to go back and ask ourselves, what problems were we trying to solve 100 years ago when we invented, budgeting and planning and compensation, performance reviews, financial reporting, and so on? And basically the problem we were trying to solve was we were trying to drive variability and variety out of things. We were trying to get people to show up every day at work, to conform to product standards, to quality standards, to budgets, to timetables. So basically we routinized work. In the process, we routinized human beings. It was a huge accomplishment, the fact that, pretty much all of us probably on this call today, we have a digital device in every pocket. We have a car or two in the garage. All of that is thanks to, folks figuring out how do you do things over and over again with ever-increasing productivity, you know, almost perfect replicability. And that was just like, that was a giant problem that human beings solved. Unfortunately, as we were saying a minute ago, it's not the challenge that confronts organizations today. So we're left with organizations that are filled with kind of legacy management practices that make them inertial, that make them uninspiring, that make them like not too innovative. And just to take a couple of examples, because it's easy to make these big general statements, but you've got to really peel this back and understand specifically what is getting in the way of our organizations being more adaptable and more innovative and so on. Let me give you just two really quick things.
Yeah, yeah.
One is, in the old pyramid, in the traditional pyramid structure, the power for setting strategy and direction tended to be concentrated at the top. So as much as we might talk about empowerment, the fact of the matter was, it's the CEO, a few vice presidents, the board, that decides the big shifts in strategy, direction, and so on. The dilemma with that is, most of those people at the top have a lot of their emotional equity invested in the past. Take a classic example. For the last, 15 or so years before he stepped down at Microsoft, Bill Gates was the company's chief software architect. And over that time frame, Microsoft was late to most of the big changes in the software industry, despite being filled with amazingly bright people. And by the way, this is not a slam on Microsoft. This is true of just about every company. But if you look, if you could open Bill Gates' head, he had a commitment to selling software with one particular way, licensing fees. The PC was at the center of the computing universe. His primary customers were other big industrial companies. And that mindset, I think, interfered with Microsoft really being adaptable. So in that old model, a fairly small number of people can hold the organization's capacity to change hostage to their own personal willingness to adapt and change. And that's why so many companies ultimately end up missing big changes in the external environment, because we've over-concentrated the power for strategy, for direction at the top of those organizations. That's like a very practical example.
Do you think that's the problem with Kodak?
You know what? I think that's the problem with just about every large organization. Think about it this way. The single biggest reason companies typically come off the boil, they fail to change, they fail to adapt, is that the leaders in those companies fail to write off their own depreciating intellectual capital. So, it's pretty hard to admit that when you're at the top of the tree.
Their personal intellectual capital, their own essentially systems of beliefs and understanding of how the world works.
Absolutely.
Okay, now this is an interesting concept. So how does an individual then depreciate his or her decaying, value-losing intellectual assets? I mean, let me put it. I like the way that you put it, but another way to think about this is how do human beings unlearn things?
Yep. In fact, I would say typically you have to unlearn before you can learn. And in fact, it's very interesting, all the stuff that's been written about innovation and so on, one of the things that almost always gets missed in that is, before you can innovate in any sphere, whether it's in a business model, a product, or management itself, you have to deconstruct what you already believe. And you have to ask, how much of what I believe is simply, the dead hand of precedent? How much of it is habit? How much of it is unexamined assumption? And, there are some ways of doing that by looking for outliers that kind of provide a contrary example, by talking to people from other fields and other disciplines who don't start with your kind of paradigmatic beliefs, by talking to young people whose minds haven't been, captured yet by one way of thinking. But it starts, Dan, I would argue, by being honest about the fact that denial is a very typical human tendency. And, organizations don't usually miss the future because it's unpredictable, but they often miss it because it's unpalatable, that they simply didn't, it's true for the music industry, it was true for Kodak, it was true for Nokia, go down the list, simply couldn't quite bring themselves to admit that the future wasn't going to turn out the way they hoped.
I think that's a powerful analysis, and it's one that I think that all of us, in our personal capacities or even in our roles in organizations, it makes me worried a little bit. I hear that analysis. I think, okay, what am I missing? What dead hand of precedent am I abiding by that I shouldn't be? But let's go at an even deeper level than the dead hand of precedent. And let me say here, partway we're moving along at a rapid clip here. We're talking to Gary Hamel, legendary business thinker, management scholar. He's the author of What Matters Now, How to Win in a World of Relentless Change, Ferocious Competition, and Unstoppable Innovation. If you have a question, we've got a lot of people lined up with questions already, but if you have a question and you're listening to this live, hit star 2 on your phone, and we'll see you essentially raising your hand on our control panel, and then I'll try to call on as many people as we can. And also, we got a lot of questions coming in via Twitter. Remember, if you're listening to this on iTunes, don't press star 2 on your phone. It's not going to work. Gary, you talk in the book a lot, and I thought this was one of the most interesting aspects of it. You talk a lot about values. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, you actually lead by talking about the notion of values, which is not – it's a lot of time in business parlance, in management consulting, we sort of pay lip service to that. But you have a different take, and you say – and I want to quote something in the book here that I think is – it's just remarkable. Here we go. Here's what Gary says. What's required is nothing less than a moral renaissance in business. Okay, moral renaissance, Gary, that's heavy. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, capitalism as a method of economic production depends on having a lot of freedom, that economic actors with a lot of freedom. That's what distinguishes it from a centrally planned economy. And again, all of us have benefited enormously from that freedom, you know, the right to buy and sell as we see fit, to start a company, to close the company down, to move assets from one use to another. And, of course, what you've seen over the last decade or two is you've seen, you know, a huge amount of kind of egregious, extraordinarily selfish behavior from banks, from other institutions that have besmirched the good name of capitalism. And some people see this as, you know, the fault is in the system itself. I don't think that's correct. I mean, if you go back to Adam Smith and everybody else who's written about this, they all understood that capitalism can't work unless the most powerful actors within capitalism are really kind of guardians of a certain level of moral standards, that they are fiduciaries, that they behave with prudence, that they are accountable, that they believe in equity and have a certain amount of charity as well. And when those values start to disappear, capitalism collapses in on itself. And I think that's what we've seen. And, you know, one way of trying to cope with that is obviously through legislation, things
regulation.
Like Sarbanes-Oxley or the Frank-Dodd
Act.
We can slowly tie these
that,
institutions
Gary.
Up and not.
Yeah.
But I think that's not the way. I think what instead is you got to, you know, at the same time we're looking for legislative solutions, you have to look inside of each one of us. We have to look inside of our heart and say, what values am I really driven by?
Well, and I think that divide there, I don't want to turn this into Office Hours Moral Philosophy Edition, but there is a really interesting distinction here that you also see playing out inside of companies, which is the difference between essentially principle-based systems and rule-based systems. And when we see things go awry in public policy, we always want to impose a rule-based system. But if the principles aren't in place in the first place, it often doesn't work very well. And you see that same thing true inside of companies as well. We're talking to Gary Hamill. Star 2 is a way to ask a question. We got a lot of folks lined up. I want to go to Twitter here, Gary, for a couple of questions. This is a question that we probably heard before, but I want to get your take on it. It's from Siddhartha Hertigan. He's actually at the United States Naval Academy. And he says to you, Gary, how do you view leadership as opposed to management? We've heard that distinction a lot, but is this an important distinction in today's workplace?
You know, I think less and less. You know, historically, I think we had this kind of view about leadership that you had executives that exercised a lot of leadership, and that meant setting directions, setting values, getting the right people in the big jobs and so on. Then you had managers who were kind of in the middle somewhere, coordinating top to bottom, holding people accountable, and then you had people down on the front lines, the operators. So that's, I think, that notion of leadership historically corresponded to kind of that sense of levels in an organization. What I see happening is that the work of managing and or leading, depending on how you want to describe it, that work is getting pushed more and more out to the periphery of organizations. It's true in the military where you can have, you know, a young soldier out in the field calling in, you know, airstrikes. It's true in large organizations. So you know, and what's happening is that even the work, you know, that classic work of leadership, of setting strategy, setting direction, values, that is now getting syndicated out to the entire organization. You've seen this in a company recently. It's a story up on the Mix, 3M, looking for new growth strategies. You bid that problem out to the whole organization. You look what IBM has done a couple of times in recent years with their global innovation jams, where in a sense you're almost crowdsourcing the strategy of the place. you see other organizations like Red Hat who are getting kind of company-wide conversations going about what our values should be. So I think the role, you know, now, do we still need people who have courage and who have, you know, all those attributes I talked about earlier, prudence and foresight and self-denial? Absolutely. Those are kinds of questions of character, and we need leaders with the right kind of character. But the actual work of leading, that job is, like, too big to be done by any one individual anymore. But I kind of think the whole leadership development industry is a little bit bankrupt because we keep telling ourselves that, you know, maybe sooner or later we can find these extraordinary leaders, that maybe you can find, you know, this person who has the innovation instincts of Steve Jobs, you know, the moral intelligence of Desmond Tutu, the political wisdom of Lee Kuan Yew, whatever. Those people, not many of them exist, right? There was only one Steve Jobs in the last 50 years, not likely to be another one. So it seems to me in all of this, the real question is not how do you find extraordinary leaders, but how do you build organizations that can thrive with kind of ordinary leaders? Because most of us, that's what we are. And that means syndicating that work out to more people, getting the best ideas from across the whole company, but not putting too much faith or too much hope in some small elite group that is supposedly, you know, going to find our way to the future.
There you go. Okay, so it's another. So this is. I think I got to ask a question here from a Twitter. Then we're going to go to the phones here. We got a lot of folks lining up here. So Gary is, if not, Gary is a smart, insightful, provocative dude. But he lays down a couple of really interesting ideas. So he's basically saying that we got this priesthood of managers at the top who might be part of the problem. That leadership development is in some ways a bankrupt, his word, enterprise. I'm going to go to Twitter here. Then we're going to open up the phones because everybody wants in now, Gary. You've got them riled up here. We got Rhett Laubach. He's in. He is in Arcadia. He's in Arcadia, Oklahoma. And he says via Twitter to you, Gary, what amount of and which of the management problems in your book, and the book is What Matters Now, can be sourced back to what he calls miseducation at MBA programs?
You know, I think some of it for sure. I think most MBA programs are still based on kind of management 1.0 principles. I mean, just the very idea of management as a discipline. You know, there's some folks in some leading business schools that think management should be kind of, you know, like being a lawyer or being a physician, that it's this kind of profession. I don't think so. I think all of us are managing every day. But historically, business schools were training people to go in on a management track, to climb that ladder, to hopefully end up one day as CEO and give big gifts back to the institution. And when you start to look at some of the organizations I talk about in the book that have no formal management hierarchy at all, and some of these are pretty big, substantial organizations now, you start to ask, well, what does it really mean to be a manager? It doesn't mean to be part of some kind of caste system. It doesn't mean to sit somewhere in a hierarchy. It is a capability to get things done through other people. So that's, you know, and that's always going to be useful, but the role models we look at there are going to change, right? I'm much less interested today in somebody like Jack Welch, for example, than I am in Jimmy Wales or Linus Torvalds or somebody else who knows how to bring people together, get extraordinary things done without having to use the big stick of bureaucratic power. So that kind of paradigm shift in how we think about managing, I don't think that's fully permeated the business schools yet. And to be fair to them, most of their graduates are still going into companies that are based on the old model. So their clients, if you like, their customers for all those young MBA graduates, you know, are still based on the old model. Having said that, I think business schools have to be out in front on this. Most of them are not doing the kind of real experimental research that is going to help us invent management 2.0, and I think that's a shame. We're hoping to maybe help to change that. But so, yeah, they're definitely part of the problem, and most of them still are kind of stuck in the old model.
Part of the solution, which I want to get to in a moment, I just want to bracket this for our listeners who might have read Gary's piece in the December issue of the Harvard Business Review, with, of course, the classically, is it Hamel-esque, Hamelian, Hamel-ish, the classic headline, first let's fire all the managers. And it's an extraordinary case study about a company, a food processing company called Morningstar. But before we get to that, let's open up the phones here. I want to go to Jeffrey in Worthington, Ohio. Jeffrey, fellow Buckeye, you're on the air. Jeffrey, are you with us?
Oh, it's Susan.
Oh, it's Susan. Hi, Susan.
I'm sorry.
I guess you're using Jeffrey's phone.
Yeah, right. Well, on the other half. And when you said Worthington, I was like, oh my God, there's someone from Worthington calling. Sorry.
All roads lead to Central Ohio, as you know. So it's Susan.
What's your question for Gary? Yeah.
What's your question from Gary?
So my question for Gary is about sustainability, and you know, how do we transform the model of success and how we look to the values of who we are and leadership in a more sustainable model for a long-term future?
You know, I think part of the, you know, obviously there's a lot of aspects to that, but I would say the fundamental thing is we need leaders who see themselves not as mercenaries but as stewards. And I think what's happened over the last decade, you know, and not everywhere, not universally, but in all too many companies, we've had folks who really think of themselves as there for a short term, and the average tenure for CEOs has been coming down over recent years. But they see themselves as being there for the short term. Their only goal is to kind of pop the share price, pocket the gains, and then move on. And that's not conducive to stewardship of any sort. It's not conducive to stewardship of the environment. It's not conducive to stewardship over the human assets and resources in a firm. So, you know, and by the way, the next big kind of management prize, the M Prize, which we run periodically on the Mixed website with McKinsey and Company and Harvard Business Review, the next big contest we're running is around curing capitalism of short-termism. So
oh, yeah.
I think if you kind of tune into that, you'll see a lot of amazing, amazing answers to that question. But it starts by, I think, changing the time horizon of senior executives, number one, and also helping them understand that today you are responsible for the second and third order effects of all of your actions, things that impact your supplier base in Asia, things that impact the environment. You cannot simply hand off those externalities and say that's somebody else's problem, because today, customers, voters, citizens, they're holding you responsible for all the systemic effects of your organization. You just got to face up to that, understand it, and deal with it.
Thank you, Susan, for that call. What are the some of the ideas that have trickled in, if any yet, to combat this idea of short-termism? I mean, I think there's a systemic problem, at least in public corporations, which is that the whole point of the exercise for many firms is simply to maximize shareholder value. And that is, if you go back to the idea of values and principles, that is the overriding principle, the overriding goal of these enterprises. But and the thing is that these executives get punished and rewarded very much for short-term performance. So what are some ways to go beyond short-termism?
Well, you know, I think certainly compensation schemes, so putting more of an executive's compensation at risk over time, so it's not just an annual bonus that you only get a payout if you maintain performance at a certain level over a longer period of time. It means leaving people probably in their jobs longer so you can measure the impact of their actions over time. And part of it, you know, may have a solution in how we treat capital gains and so on. But I would argue, you know, the problem isn't so much that we're focused on shareholder wealth. You know, I think the problem is that we turn the scoreboard into the game. Because if you think about it, measuring shareholder wealth, all we're saying is we expect institutions to use society's resources wisely. And that means you ought to be able to produce outputs that are worth more than your inputs, and we call that shareholder return. And you know, we don't want organizations that don't do that. But that's kind of a de minimis standard. And I think what happened in a lot of companies is executives started to mistake the scoreboard for the game. And I lived in England for a while, and I used to have this image, you know, the old-fashioned cricket a pitch with the folks up behind the scoreboard putting in the numbers, you know, by hand. Baseball, I guess, the same way. I used to have this like image of the top management team all huddled behind the scoreboard wildly trying to manipulate the numbers, but the real game of creating value lies somewhere else, and you see that in companies like Apple and Google and others. But I think a lot of executives got the, you know, they wanted to take a shortcut. Let me just manipulate the scoreboard. That will ultimately catch up with you. So we haven't launched that contest yet, Dan. We're going to launch it in the next few weeks, but I expect a lot of ideas of that ilk.
It's a great topic. Short-termism is hurting this country and this world. Let's go to Bill in Tucson, Arizona. Bill, you're on the air with Gary Hamill. What's your question?
My question is this: if deconstruction is really the foundation for a new 2.0 management. Wouldn't it be prudent to have a focus on developing a movement around that rather than such a focus on 2.0?
Well, I think, you know, you deconstruct before you reconstruct. But I think the important point for me in all of this is we are now at a point, I think, in management history where we really have to look at our core principles. You know, in any field of human endeavor, you ultimately reach a point where you can't solve the new problems with the old principles. You couldn't build constitutional democracies on the principles of feudalism. You couldn't understand the subatomic world if you start with Newtonian physics. And I think that's where we are right now with management. And what I find kind of, you know, in a way worrying, although I think there's a lot of opportunity to do this, you know, we've had for 100 years, we've had this management system that we call bureaucracy, and it's kind of interesting. I've never met an executive who claims to be a champion of bureaucracy, but I've never met or I've hardly ever found an organization that isn't based kind of on the principles of bureaucracy. So we all know we don't like it, but we haven't had very many alternatives. And I think, and it's hard to find an alternative until you go right down to your core starting assumption. And if you've kind of peel it all away, the ideology that's underneath most of our organizations, I would term as controlism. And, you know, you go to an average thesaurus, you look up the first synonym to the word manage, it's the word control. So we had this way of, you know, how do you control people? How do you put them in a box? And by the way, control is important. Accountability is important. But we got it in a particular way. We got it with a lot of supervision. We got it by taking a lot of discretionary authority away from people, imposing what Dan said, kind of something that's based on rules and not on principles. So you end up with organizations that are not very flexible and people who are not very motivated. So, you know, which we've known, by the way, for a very long time. You go back, you know, 50-some years, Douglas MacGregor, The Human Side of Enterprise, Theory X, Theory Y. I mean, he knew, we've known for a long time that people are not very motivated at work. We've had programs of engagement, empowerment, job enrichment. We don't call them employees. We call them associates. All of this stuff we've done. But until we change the underlying ideology, no program, no change in language is going to do anything except create more cynicism.
All right, let's move beyond controlism here for a second and say, you know, I don't want to get into I don't want us to diagnose like a lion and prescribe like a lamb, because there aren't many examples of whatever the opposite of controlism is. But there is one really powerful one. I want to talk about that, Gary. It's in the book, Gary's book here, What Matters Now, How to Win in a World of Relentless Change, Ferocious Competition, and Unstoppable Innovation. And it's also a really great article in the December 2011 issue of the Harvard Business Review. And when I say great, I will actually give it the writer's what I think is the highest compliment a writer can give to another. When I read this, I said to myself, expletive deleted. I should have written that. I should have gotten that story. It's just such a great example. But I'm going to read you the lead here, and then Gary can expand on it here. So he says, I'm quoting Gary here, we are all prisoners of the familiar. Many things, the first iPhone, J.K. Rowling's Wizardly World, Lady Gaga's sirloin gown, were difficult to envision until we encountered them. So it is with organizations. It's tough to imagine a company where no one has a boss. Employees negotiate responsibilities with their peers. Everyone can spend the company's money. Each individual is responsible for acquiring the tools needed to do his or her job. There are no titles and no promotions. Compensation decisions are peer-based. Sound impossible? It's not. And Gary goes to write about a company called Morningstar, which has, I think, one of the most unique, even radical approaches to coordinating and producing and doing great work by essentially, I think, throwing off what seems to be almost all the shackles of control. So tell us a little bit about Morningstar. First of all, tell us what Morningstar does.
Yeah, just a couple of quick things. So Morningstar is the largest processor of tomatoes in the world. They're here in the Central Valley of California. If you ever, you know, had salsa, ketchup, spaghetti sauce, you probably had their products. They sell to the big food processors. You know, what makes them unique is not only the fact that they've been growing for 20 years, they've, pushed a lot of their competitors out of business, But the fact that the company, which is about $700 million a year in revenue, about 400 full-time employees, that the company is built around the principles of self-management. And, you know, we don't have enough time to unpack it all, but let me give you a couple of anecdotes that, that Dan was referring to.
Yeah. Yeah.
So first of all, there are no people with managerial roles. Every employee has the right to issue a purchase order. So if I'm, you know, if I'm a mechanic somewhere in this company maintaining pieces of equipment, I think I need a new welder, you know, I don't go to the head of purchasing to get a requisition. I can issue a purchase order, send it straight off to the vendor. When it comes back, I have to sign off that the equipment has been received. Then there is somebody who will pay it, but there's nobody kind of intervenes between that person making that purchase decision. And just to give you an example of one of the things that makes that work is, first of all, the company, 400 people, is divided into 20-some business units. So business units are small, which is a very important design principle, I think, of Management 2.0. Every
yeah.
couple of weeks, every employee sees all of the financial data for every one of those business units. So they're very attuned to who's making money, losing money, who's on budget, off budget. So you could make your purchase decision, but everybody's going to see it. Everybody's going to be able to judge over time whether that was a wise decision or not. And you know, and if it's not, they're all your peers are also in control of your compensation. What they've done kind of interestingly is they've trained many, if not most, of their employees, I was going to say first level, but they're all first level, they've trained many or most of them to do financial analysis, to do net present value analysis, return on investment, and so on. So the folks who are making those decisions, they're not making them, you know, on a hunch. They're doing all the analysis. You know you're going to be held accountable for that decision, so you talk to a lot of your peers and colleagues and make sure that you haven't missed something. But their principle is how do we move expertise down to the front lines, down to the people who are actually operating there, rather than moving decisions up to people who may have expertise but lack the context. So that's just one small example out of a dozen or two about why
I love the purchasing example, because to me what I mean, and I actually have the article right here in front of me, and I have written and that when you got to that part of it, I have underlined it and starred it. Because, you know, it's one of those functions with inside of a firm that we often don't think about a lot, which is how do you acquire stuff? And every organization has a purchasing department, and you got to get sign-off. And this is so radical, and it's so antithetical to control. And people say, well, won't folks take advantage of it? But you're saying, of course not. Now, let's talk some more nitty-gritty about what they do here, because there's so much interesting stuff. Every employee at Morningstar draws up a personal mission statement. All of us have seen corporate mission statements, most of which are written in a language other than English, even for American companies. But you're saying each employee at Morningstar draws up a personal mission statement. What is that, and why does it matter?
Well, the view there is that you don't report to a boss, you report to your mission. And so when you get hired in some area, you know, you'll spend some time learning what the company does, learning, you know, in your particular business unit department what people do. And your job is to find a way of describing the value you're going to add to that, and that is your mission statement. But that's really only the beginning. Then you will negotiate. They call it a colleague letter of understanding. But if you think about it, these are not quite independent contractors, but they really treat it almost as a market where you will negotiate your responsibilities with 10 or 12 of the peers whose work affects you and where you affect them, so kind of your own network inputs, outputs. You'll negotiate with them, here's what I'm going to provide you. So maybe you're providing the steam that drives the big cooking machinery in the company. So how many BTUs of heat, with what reliability, at what cost, you negotiate that. And then people at the end of the year will hold you accountable for how you did with that agreement. So it's the kind of deep story about what Morningstar has done. You know, economists for a long time, they believe there were only two kind of diametrically opposed ways of organizing human effort. One was a marketplace, which is kind of the invisible hand, and markets are certainly capable of some very interesting kind of coordination, but they really solve fairly simple coordination problems, like how do you get apples into a marketplace. They don't solve the kinds of coordination problems you have when you're running this big capital-intensive, process-intensive, highly integrated manufacturing plant. And for that, economists said, you have to have a firm. You have to have a company where everybody reports up to one hierarchy, and for economists, the kind of central defining characteristic of a firm is that it's decentralized. So what you see in a place like Morningstar is a company that has kind of the freedom and flexibility advantages of a market, which are by definition highly decentralized, but has the coordination and control advantages of a traditional company, which are typically very much centralized. Morningstar is not. So it's kind of, you know, it's best of both. And I would say, Dan, that, you know, as rare as that example is, it's certainly not the only one. Another company I've written about, you would know about, W.L. Gore and Associates,
oh, sure.
Famous for Gore-Tex. You know, this is a company with 9,000 employees and not a single boss. Nobody, no EVPs, SVPs, department heads, divisional directors, where compensation decisions are made by your peers, not by the higher-ups. So there's a lot of evidence that this model can scale, that it can be used in highly complex organizations, but it's a little bit disconcerting if you spent your life, you know, crawling up the hierarchy and learning how to wield bureaucratic power.
Let's take some more questions here. Let's go to Lee in Keller, Texas. Lee in Keller, Texas. You're on the air.
Hey, Dan.
Lee.
Bob Watkins here.
Oh, it's Bob, not
yeah,
me.
Another
okay.
Spouse. Another okay. Other. Hi, Gary. Thanks for taking my question. I'm wondering how the whole macro economy affects the ability of change agents to make changes like you're proposing. I'm sure that a lot of people are thinking twice about rocking the boat or you know, heaven forbid, changing jobs in an environment like this where they would, you know, it seems like the traditional managers have the upper hand in this battle simply by virtue of the economic conditions. Is it possible to make significant change without the economy getting better first?
Whenever we're in a tough economic situation, people do tend to put their heads down and I think become a little bit more conservative. On the flip side of that, I think there are a lot of leaders out there who understand that we don't have simply a cyclical issue right now. It's not just like we're going through a very difficult business downturn, but there's some big secular challenges as well. I mean, most senior leaders I talk to, they may not yet kind of get this new way of thinking, but they know the old model is slowly becoming irrelevant. And most of them are quite happy to have, new suggestions, new ideas, and so on. I think, unfortunately, people who are kind of in the middle or lower down in organizations, they've basically been told for most of their careers that they cannot initiate deep system change. So, you know, that's up to the head of HR, the head of HT, the head of planning, some vice president somewhere. And so, a lot of folks in organizations have a learned helplessness. They don't really believe they can initiate radical change in these core management processes from the inside. But when you come check out a lot of the stories at the Management Exchange, just managementexchange.com, you'll find a lot of people who are doing this. And, of course, the principle behind this is experimentation. So, you know, if you think there's a better way of compensating people, of budgeting, of planning, whatever, you know, you don't start by trying to drive that across the whole organization. You find something you can do in your unit, within your team, as a small experiment to kind of test this idea out. And
you get a lot of people. I agree with that. I think that there's a, as you know, Gary, there's a whole literature on small wins. There's a whole literature that there's. I think a lot of times systemic change begins in a more catalytic way by people on the ground who see a different ground truth than the managers actually doing something. But people have a resistance to conducting some of these experiments. Do you think that they should just do they need to get permission for this, or do they do it under the radar? I mean, if you are, you know, someone in the middle of these organizations, you know, in the middle of an organization, you feel like we're in this sclerotic kind of institution where things are not moving. You've read Gary Hamel's book, What Matters Now. You've seen the example of Morningstar. I mean, what should that person do?
You know, I think what you look for is small. You take the principle that you're trying to build into that organization, whether it's self-management, whether it's transparency, whether it's meritocracy, but you take a critical principle and you ask yourself, how could I demonstrate that principle, the power of that principle, in a fairly non-threatening way where I don't need a lot of permissions, something that I can do in, you know, a few days? I mean, let me give you kind of a crazy example. An Australian software company called Atlassian, and they make kind of corporate wikis and social media software for organizations.
Sure, no, we've talked about Atlassian on this program. I've written about Atlassian. It's a great example.
All
go
right,
for
there
it.
You go.
Yeah.
So, you know, a few years back, they got, and at that time, it was even a smaller company. They have VC funding. They're under the gun to grow like crazy. And they saw, you know, Google's policy about giving their engineers 20% of their time to work on whatever they choose. And so they were thinking, well, like, that's interesting, but only a company like Google can afford that. You have to be kind of really rich to afford that. I think they might have gotten cause and effect mixed up. But anyway, they said you can only do this, like, once you're big and successful. And so they asked, but the principle was still intriguing. How do you give people time to work on the things they're passionate about? So they decided they would take that idea, which, by the way, I can tell you, if you went, you know, to your manager and say, let's give everybody 20% of the time to work on whatever they want, you'd just, like, be thrown out the door. But they said, how could you test that idea literally in one day? They did something called the FedEx experiment,
sure.
You know, absolutely positively
FedEx
one day.
Yeah.
So they invited a bunch of their engineers together for a day. They said, come with an idea that you're passionate about, something that's not currently in our product plan. They let folks self-select around the ideas that people had most energy for. They said, we'll give you one day to do some work, see if you can make some real progress here. But they were testing a couple of hypotheses. Do people have ideas that are actually even more practical, faster payoff than the ones that are in our plan? Are people willing to organize around those? Are they willing to not be just parochial fight for their idea, but will they glom around the best? And are these things where we can make fast progress? Well, at the end of the day, all those hypotheses had been confirmed. They reordered some of their key development priorities, and then they've been doing this periodically ever since. So it's learning how to take, like, a big, kind of complicated, scary idea and scale it down into a small experiment and just get started.
There you go. I like it. I like the idea of, we talk about scale, but I think there's something about having this big ambition and scaling down and trying the experiment and putting it into place. We have a call from Annapolis, Maryland. Annapolis, thanks so much for waiting so long to talk to Gary. You're on the air with him.
Hey, thanks. This is actually Siddhartha Herdagan calling from the Naval Academy. You read my tweet question a little earlier, but if I could go back to that subject.
Sure.
I really liked Gary's other book, The Future of Management, his previous book. I thought that went really well, kind of hand in hand with your book, Free Agent Nation, and what the future looked like in terms of working and interacting and how we were going to manage each other. I thought it was interesting that Gary mentions Jimmy Wales as an example of how we're getting away from management or how management is changing, because I teach leadership classes here at the Naval Academy, and I use Jimmy Wales as an example of a leader. And leadership, by my definition, is, you know, you can bring people together without any external reward. They're not being forced because it's their job. They're not being paid. The majority of the people that work on Wikipedia are people that are volunteering their time because they believe in the cause and the vision that Jimmy had. So I think that is the definition of leadership, and I think we're actually moving more toward leadership, because as we get out to these individual units, they're going to pick and choose who they're going to, you know, what things they're going to work on, which projects they're going to work on, because they are inspired by the person that's heading that up.
You know, let me just comment
go ahead,
on that for a moment.
Gary.
One of the things I often ask, you know, when I'm talking to a group of executives, I give them a little assignment. I ask them the following question. I ask them to imagine they're now in an organization where they have no formal positional authority. You're not the head of any unit, any department, no positional authority, number one. And number two, you have no sanctions. You can't ding somebody's career, fire, demotivate them if they don't do what you want. And I ask them, okay, given those two things, how would you get something done? And most of them have almost no clue. And in fact, you know, talking to Terry Kelly, she's the CEO at Gore. They do have a CEO.
Right.
But, you know, I asked her, well, what's the toughest thing? When you bring in an experienced person from outside of Gore, what's the most difficult lesson you have to teach them? And the most difficult lesson is you will never be able to give an order here. You have to find other ways of persuading people, cajoling people, and so on to get them to do the right thing. And so, you know, for me, we often, you know, I'm often in these seminars where they tell me they want to talk about leadership, but I don't think you can actually talk about leadership unless you start with those two assumptions. Because if you don't start with those two assumptions, if you assume you have the positional power and you have the sanctions, then you're talking about how you use bureaucratic power. We can talk about that. That's okay. But let's not pretend we're talking about leadership. My only slight reservation of kind of separating out leadership and managing is that in doing so, we are implicitly separating out thinking and doing. And in the old model, we had doers and thinkers. I think in the new model, everybody has to be a thinker. Everybody has to be a doer. The proportions may vary day to day, task to task, but I think, I don't disagree with the fact that Jimmy Wales, these folks are leaders. They know how to mobilize. They know how to mentor. To me, those are the kind of tests They can do it without the bureaucratic power, but they're also people who get things done, right? They're not simply sitting there at the top of something giving orders. They're deeply kind of embedded with the community. They're carrying a lot of the load. So, but that's a good question to ask folks if you really want to test whether they really are talking about leadership or not.
Give it to us again. Give it that two-part question again, because I think
I think it's good for those of you who are managers out there, and I also think
it's very tweetable for all of you following on Twitter.
It's kind of one question, two parts. So just assume that you have no positional power and no sanctions. How will you get stuff done?
Great question. How
to get stuff done if you gave away your positional authority and you have no way of sanctioning other folks? And if you still think you can make amazing things happen, by golly, you're a leader.
Great point. We're going to take I want to take a Twitter question. We only have a few minutes left here, Gary. I want to take a Twitter question, and then let's go to maybe a couple more questions. We've got a lot of people lined up here that I'm not going to get to all of them. Let's go to Dunellen, New Jersey. You're on the air with Gary Hamill.
Dan, is it?
Hi, is this Dunellen, New Jersey?
It might be. It's Daniel Petter Lipstein.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Hi, Dan. Gary, great show.
What's your question, Daniel?
You know, what is the implications of what you're writing about for education, and do you have any particular thoughts about education systems like Montessori, which seem like they flow naturally, that if we want to build this new management 2.0, we really should be educating more kids around, you know, educational philosophies like Montessori, which Dan has written about in his books?
Great question.
Yeah, you know,
suggesting management by Montessori, Gary?
Again, I think, you know, the old model is pretty deeply embedded in our schools as well. They're extraordinarily hierarchical. They're based on assembly line techniques where, you know, each kid is frog marched through a fairly standardized curriculum at a fairly standardized rate of progress. This simply cannot be the way to educate a 21st century workforce. Like a lot of institutions, there are a lot of people who have a big stake in the status quo. And, you know, I think, you know, if you think about any institution, whether it's education, whether it's a large company, the rate at which any of those institutions can adapt is a function of how much experimentation is getting done. And
yeah,
I think, you know, at every state level, at every school board level, what we have to be encouraging is more experimentation. We have to be clear on the principles we're driving for. Which is teaching, you know, what Dan has written about Seligan, but teaching the new sets of conceptual skills, increasing right brain capacity, developing people who have the characterological traits that are going to make them succeed in the new economy. And our education institutions are getting in the way of that. And those of us who are parents and are thinking about this thing, you know, we got to be like a lot louder and a lot tougher and, you know, from the local level up, you know, making our voices heard, because we have an extremely powerful a set of interests that are working against this kind of a change, and, you know, it's going to be, I think, a long fight, but it's one that's worth having. In fact, I would, you know, the success of our children, the success of our economy depends on winning that battle.
Great advice as a father of three. I'm all for loud and tough parents. Let's go to we got another one from Central Ohio. Let's go to David in Columbus, Ohio. David in Columbus, you're on the air.
Thanks, Dan. Can you hear me?
Sure thing. Yes. What's your question for Gary?
First of all, big fan of both of you, Gary, all the way back to core competence of the corporation. It seems to me that the core competence model is something that we've let go of and misunderstood from the point of view of most corporations' core competence is control. Here's my question for you. I do this. I have several clients. I'm in this business. Here's the problem I always have. I get them all to read both your books, by the way, and all my sessions. But what's the model? Where do we go to? We've got a lot of descriptions of what it feels like and how to do it differently in Morningstar. But when you're dealing with an old-line company that's heavy in the bureaucracy, I think the bureaucracy and the hierarchy is there because it's the only default model we have. What's it look like? How do we get them to be able to envision where we're going with this?
So
great question,
I mean,
David. What's the new default?
The new default for me is network. It's a network view.
Okay.
It's I suppose it would, if we went back to space station of the old model, you know, like the big wheel with concentric rings connected by various lines, but the network is the only thing that I can think of.
Okay, David, thanks for the question. Gary, what do you think is the new default?
So first of all, I would say you're right that we don't yet have a clear model of you know, the alternative. It's starting to come into focus. I mean, when you start to do kind of a mashup of Morningstar, of Gore, of HCL Technologies, a big Indian company that's inverting the pyramid, then you look at some of the most complex forms of social organization on the web, you look at some of the big open source projects and so on, what you can start to do is extract the principles out of this. And I think, you know, as we're trying to find our way toward management 2.0, we're kind of, I think, where those early management pioneers were maybe around 1900, where, you know, we knew we were leaving the agrarian, the craft-based economy behind. Nobody could quite yet imagine what, you know, Ford Motor Company would look like, but we knew the challenges that we were trying to solve. And, you know, I've been talking about the challenges of adaptability, of innovation, of inspiration. So we know the challenges we need to solve. And when you go start to look at things that are already innovative and inspiring and engaging, you can start to see the principles around which you're going to have to build our new organization. So let me give you guys a really simple little exercise you can use to get this conversation started in any company. So you start by recognizing that we have a set of principles that we've baked into our organizations today, and they are standardization, specialization, hierarchy, alignment, control, extrinsic rewards. Not all of those are bad. We're not going to throw them away. This is like a both-and rather than either-or. But then you say, okay, what are the principles we need if we want something that's adaptable, innovative, and so on? So let me give you a few, and, you know, I've written about this. You can read it. I think it's one of the chapters of my last book. But take things like transparency, disaggregation, internal markets, natural hierarchies. You can start to see all these principles at work on the web, in markets, in democracy, and things that are resilient, that are adaptable. So here's a little exercise you do. Put a little matrix in front of the folks inside of your organization. Down one side, put your core management processes. So we allocate resources, we set goals, we hire, we train and develop, we review, we compensate. Whatever are those most critical processes by which your organization is run, put those down kind of one side. Those are the rows. And then take each one of those principles and put them as the columns. So transparency, passion, communities of passion, disaggregation, whatever ones that you think are really critical. And then ask people in your organization, if we wanted to instantiate, to institutionalize that particular principle in this particular process, what small change would we make? So maybe, for example, in planning, the next time we run a planning exercise, if we wanted that to be truly open and transparent, we would invite a group of, you know, 20-somethings in, and we'd give them the assignment of doing the whole strategy process in parallel with the old goats and see what they come up with. So you have to, you know, right now you have to start with the principles. You draw on the best examples we have out there. And I'll tell you, on managementexchange.com, you will find hundreds and hundreds of examples of people who are doing this all over the world. So there's in fact, that's part of why we built this, because we knew a lot of this management innovation was going on. But the process by which it was discovered, documented, disseminated was very haphazard. We're trying to bring that together. But you can start with that kind of a small exercise in the company, and I'll tell you what, it never fails. If you give people that challenge, they want to work in organizations that are more meritocratic, that are more transparent, that are more open, and you have to give them permission in a way to hack the company's management processes, to say, we want to hear your ideas. We're going to experiment with these things. We know we have to be revolutionary in our intent, but still evolutionary in our goals. But you have to get that conversation started, and you have to get them focused on the principles. Because if we start with the tactics, it's going to be more of the same. It's going to be window dressing. It'll be incremental. Start with radical principles, and then ask, what are the small practical things we can do to start to represent those in the way we manage and lead every day?
That's great, Gary. We're running out of time here. I do want to point all the listeners here to Gary's website. It's a really – we didn't have time to talk much about it, but it's a really interesting venture where he is essentially setting up a form of open innovation to reinvent management as we know it. There are a lot of really interesting case studies, a lot of really interesting interviews. He has a list of what he calls his moonshots for management. Introduces you to some people who are shaking things up. There's a blog. It's a lot of really great stuff there. The website is managementexchange.com. CoreCompetencies.com. That's where you can find a lot of really good case studies and a lot of really good models for companies that are doing these things. Unfortunately, Gary, we are out of time. Thank you for being with us on the program. The book, ladies and gentlemen, you should go out. It's available wherever books are sold. It is What Matters Now: How to Win in a World of Relentless Change, Ferocious Competition, and Unstoppable Innovation. The author is Gary Hamill. His website is managementexchange.com. That's it for Office Hours. Thanks for being with us. This program will be available for download for free in a few days at danpink.com. As I mentioned, you can learn more about Gary Hamill and his book, What Matters Now, as well as his efforts to shake up management by going to managementexchange.com. That's managementexchange.com. And join us for another great round of upcoming episodes and the chance to talk to people like Joan Allaire, Harvey McKay, Tom Peters, and many, many more who are lining up right now. Until then, for producer Joseph Hinson in Lynchburg and director Jessica Lerner here in World Headquarters, I'm Daniel Pink. You've been listening to Office Hours. If you missed an offer, I'm really sorry. You didn't make any money. If you missed an episode, check us out on iTunes. Thanks for listening.